thank you, everybody, for tuning in to this weekend's show. We've got a special guest on this week, Randy Newberg, a guy I admire immensely for his work with public lands, a guy who puts his money where his mouth is when it comes to involving himself in the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Randy, sincere thanks for taking the time to join us on Nevada Backcountry. Talk to me a little bit about growing up. Did you hunt as a kid?
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it. Anytime someone from Nevada calls, you have my attention because I grew up in northern Minnesota hunting, but I went to college in Reno. My first mule deer was taken in Nevada. The first time I saw a pronghorn was in Nevada. Even after college, I lived there for 3 years, and I'm just fascinated by the state of Nevada. It was a place where someone who grew up with the hunting background that I did in a little logging town where everybody hunted, well, that was pretty much what everybody in Nevada did. I'm like, all right, this is a place for me. Yeah. And so I have a lot of affection for Nevada. I come back anytime the draw gods will grant me a tag. Now that I'm a non-resident, that's a whole lot harder, but all this traces back to my roots. I grew up in a family where everybody hunted. It was all about the food that we got from hunting. And here I am now in my late 50s, living in Montana, hunting as much as I can.
How'd you make that leap from, hey, I like hunting, this is something enjoyable, to this is what I want to do for a career and make a living doing it?
There's maybe some premise in that question that I need to clarify that.
Okay.
The reason I kept my CPA job up until 2 years ago. This job here, it's a pursuit of passion. It's about the conservation advocacy. It's about public access. It's about all those things that are really important to me. And I feel blessed that financially I can do it because I love it. And I'd love to give credit to myself, but my wife told me when we started this in 2008, she said, you got to promise me this will never be our livelihood because you'll grow to hate it. And if you hated hunting, you'd be the most miserable person in the world.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of been a second job, if you want to call it that. But I got into it by accident in some respects. I wanted to give more voice to public lands, to access, to conservation, to people who hunted the way I hunted. And I wasn't seeing a lot of that in media. So I said, well, let me go see if I can make a go of it. Here we are 15 years later.
I've seen interviews with you before. I regard you very highly for your work in the public lands issues. And I've stolen some of your talking points when I get on my soapbox.
Yeah.
So thanks.
I know, I've done the same thing. I've watched some of your talks and speeches at organizations and on YouTube. I got a question, like, where do you see the best platform for getting that public land word out?
Yeah, that's really an interesting question that we're evaluating all the time. And I have to admit, I'm not a social media person. If you told me to post something on Instagram, I wouldn't know how to do it. I'd walk over to one of my younger employees and say, hey, someone wants us to post something here. And they do it. So, you know, a lot of people say that social media is a place to reach people. But do you really have much direction or guidance? Do you leave them with much? I feel that my podcasts and my videos, which are longer form content, we can really get into the discussion. We can talk about both sides of an issue. We can give more information, tell better stories. So I'm more of a long form person, just in the way that I tell stories and want to engage with people, than I am a quick like sort of thing that you get on social media. So I would say my podcast and my YouTube channel are the place where we make the biggest difference in trying to advocate for those things we stand for.
And go ahead, Randy, plug those real quick. I've forgotten your introduction.
Sure.
To name the show On Your Own Adventure, Fresh Tracks.
Yeah.
Plug all that stuff for a second.
Sure. It started as a TV show called On Your Own Adventures, and then we changed it over to Fresh Tracks once we switched networks. And so now the best place to find us is we have a YouTube channel, Fresh Tracks with Randy Newberg. We have a podcast called Hunt Talk Radio. We have an elk-specific podcast called the Elk Talk Podcast. And then we have our own proprietary platform, kind of like Tim Burnett has with Solo Nation. We have one, Fresh Tracks Plus, where you go to freshtracks.tv and you can get stuff ad-free, you know, not having to deal with the algorithm of some, you know, technology company building a profile around you and all that.
Right.
So those are the places most people find us. I have a large forum, which people think forums are old school, but they're probably the original form of social media. We have a very large and active forum with a lot of Nevada members on there called hunttalk.com. And then we have the normal Instagram, Facebook stuff of Fresh Tracks. But like I said earlier, I view them as a communication tool, but that's about as deep as I get into those two platforms.
You're in good company then. We actually just recently gave away a Mountain Tough Plus package to a listener, and it took Dave and I about 2 weeks to figure out how to actually get in touch with the winner via social media. So we're in the same boat.
Oh, that's funny. We
finally took
some of those similar views.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It finally took just posting a public thing on our page and saying, hey, you won. We don't know how to use this thing, but track us down and we'll get it to you.
Yeah. We were just completely honest. We're like, we have no idea what we're doing. We put the cart way ahead of the horse. We have no idea what button to push.
But we adapted and overcame, man. Got it done.
Yeah.
So, hey, Randy, this is actually, I cut my teeth in sales and the hunting industry for this company. It was prior to partnering with you. But talk to me a little bit about the partnership with Legacy Sports International. You've got a signature rifle there. I know I've gotten to fondle and play with their new super light Howa rifle, which just blown away that you can have basically a 4.5 pound rifle that's accurate and durable. But talk to me a little bit about that partnership and your signature product with them.
Yeah, that's a fun one to talk about in the context of Nevada. They're based right there in Reno.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Legacy Sports is the North American distributor for Howa rifles. And they came to me in 2010, and I'd heard about their rifles because some of my friends who build their own rifles, they were always fond of the Howa barreled actions to build custom rifles from. So they sent me some, and I'm like, well, these are pretty darn good. They're way better than I am. And so over time, we built a relationship, and we've just been using their rifles now for over 12 years. I think we're starting our 13th season with them. In that process, they came to me and said, Randy, we get a lot of questions about what rifle you are using, what, you know, when you're elk hunting, is it this, is it that? So I think it was 3 years ago we started, maybe 4 years ago, with the Randy Newberg series of rifles with them. And they do a run of them and send them out to the retailers, and they're gone, and then they do another run of them. Those rifles are the same rifles you see us using out there. And then last year they came out with the, that you referenced, the Super Light, which is 4 pounds, 7 ounces. And they sent me one. I'm thinking to myself, oh boy, this is awful light. I wonder how it shoots. Well, I like a lot of their rifles, or all their rifles. It shoots a lot better than I do. Last year mine shot 2 elk and my 308 Super Light. And it's really nice to carry that really light rifle up and down the elk mountains. Be taking it to Alaska later this week. I'm going up there black bear hunting, and I'll have my Super Light 308 with me. And everybody who sees it, they say, let me see this thing. And they grab it, and the first thing, their arm almost lifts up because they're expecting a heavy rifle.
Right.
I'm like, oh my goodness, where did I get one of these? Go down to, you know, wherever. Anyhow, a retailer, they'll be able to get you one.
Myself to Howa 308. and I acquired it a little while ago. Well, a couple years ago, my wife ended up with a antelope tag, shorter than ear. She wanted to shoot, get her confidence going. So we got her out there, and she shot that 308, and now it's no longer mine.
Yeah.
So I gotta find another Hawa 308 so I can make it mine.
Yeah, for me, it's just fun to work with a company that's based in Reno. I get there very often, you know, having went to college there. Have a lot of friends in the area. My wife's brother lives there. So every time I go there, I stop in and see the folks at Legacy. And we do a lot of brainstorming about new ideas, new rifles, how we can use them, you know, all that sort of stuff. So them being right in Reno is really handy for me.
And I like Andy McCormick, who's a heck of a guy. I've known Andy, gosh, better part of a decade now. I've known him a long time, but I always tell him I live vicariously through Andy because I've got four kids. So, you know, it's like pulling teeth to scrape out some time to get out and hunt for myself. Whereas Andy, it seems like every time I get in touch with him, he's out fishing. He's, you know, stacking turkeys. He's doing whatever. Both he and Debbie hunt like crazy. So it's always nice to have somebody as the head of a company that really uses their product and, you know, tries everything out in the field.
Yeah, just field test it all. Yeah.
That would be Andy McCormick. He's the most creative person I know in the outdoor space. And he's one of the most dedicated outdoors people I know in the outdoor space.
Couldn't agree more. Now, switching gears a little bit, what is the number one issue you see facing public lands hunters? I know this is something you're passionate about. What do you see the number one issue being?
For me, it's a combination between access and habitat. In some instances, I'd say habitat. In some instances, I'd say access.
Okay.
In Nevada, your NDAO puts out their big game, I'll call it the state of the state of big game in Nevada, and they put that book out. It's, you know, 100 pages, couple hundred pages. Every unit for every species that I read when they sent it to me here probably a month ago, number one thing facing those animals out there, feral horses.
Yep.
And not necessarily the horse itself, but the habitat destruction that comes from those horses.
Right.
So in a state with 85% public land in Nevada, it's not so much access for you guys as it is the habitat degradation that is happening. And you have this Wild Horse and Burro Act that makes it very difficult to do anything about it at the state level. It's a federal issue. You're in a really tough spot on that. And I wish I had the answer, but to your question, those are the places, I use that as an example. There are other places where cheatgrass has taken over southern Idaho, parts of western Utah. We have other places where habitat just is not strong enough to give us the resilient herd numbers that are resilient to weather events and resilient to predation. So across the West, in many instances, we're seeing herd numbers decline. And it's always been hunters who've rescued the day for that and have stepped forth through their money, through their donations, through their advocacy that have changed that. And we're facing a lot of that right now. And so I think on a larger landscape, hunting is public land hunting is most endangered because of habitat degradation. Now, I'd go to a lot of other places, like where I live in Montana, 2/3 of the state is private land. And we're having a big transition where old farmer ranchers who would let you have access are selling to out-of-state people who are very, very wealthy. And they just close it down to no hunting, not outfitting, not hunting, not anything. And when those people get displaced who previously hunted those private lands, they get moved to public land. And so loss of access, whether it's public or private, is a huge issue in other parts.
Dave and I just did a show on the new Senate Bill 90 that they are trying to get passed here in Nevada to designate, they're titling it the Wild Mustang Act or whatever, and they want to designate the state horse as the Wild Mustang. And as Dave and I went into, I won't go into it again, but there are no wild Mustangs. They are feral horses. No, they're feral. Destructive as all get out. And the last thing we want is one more, you know, hurdle to clear to manage these things. So, yeah, you hit the nail on the head with the Nevada issue.
Yeah, I read that bill. I've been watching it from afar. I'm waiting. Maybe your next legislative session, you'll introduce the Russian thistle as your state plant.
Or bingo. Yeah, the cheatgrass. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, is this for real? Am I reading this right? But, yeah. Yeah, so, I guess they say the truth is stranger than fiction very often.
No, very much so. Randy, I got a question for you. So with all of this said, what is your best advice for hunters and outdoors people that want to be future advocates to spread the word and gain supporters for this? Like, I go to a lot of the CAB meetings, the County Advisory Board meetings, and the Wildlife Commission meetings, and you don't see a whole lot of the public there. I always thought that would be a great place for people to show up and voice their concerns about Nevada's natural habitat.
Yeah, it would. You know, that what's the old saying? The 99% of getting something done is just showing up.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. And like the rest of our society, hunters are busy. We're, you know, we got families, businesses, church obligations, you know, whatever it is. We are all busy, and I get that. But if we don't show up, we're going to get handed what we probably don't want.
Yeah.
We also have a lot of really good hunter advocacy groups. When I think about Nevada, I think about your Water Guzzler and Water Development Program. I'm a life member of Nevada Bighorns Unlimited. I went down and did a film about the Fraternity of Desert Bighorns and down in Vegas. And you guys have some really good active grassroots on the ground groups there. In addition to the national groups, you know, like the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Mueller Foundation, all those. Every one of those groups could use your help, whether it's your time, whether it's your talent, or whether it's your, as we call it, treasure or money. Conservation is getting more expensive every day. Advocacy is getting more expensive. It requires more relationships. It requires more members. If you show up and you say, well, I've got 5 members, you're not going to get many people's attention.
Right.
If you show up and say, you know what, I have 5,000 members right here in Washoe County or in Elko County or wherever, guess what? You're going to get somebody's attention. So these types of things that we've kind of, I don't know if we've just let them stay, you know, static for too long or what term I'd put to it, but we haven't kept up with the need of advocacy in terms of our showing up, like you were talking about, Dave, that, you know, it'd be nice if you'd go to a commission meeting and there'd be 200 hunters there. Well, there's only 3.
Right.
We got to start getting back into that mode. That's what our parents and grandparents did. That's how they changed the direction for wildlife on this planet or this continent anyhow. And we can't say, well, someone else will do it. We are that someone else. So those are the kind of things of involvement. We could list off all kinds of them, you know, going to your legislative hearings, talking to your county commissioners, talking to somebody who you know who is involved in policy. It's amazing how much of a difference a relationship makes in that. So if you know somebody who's a decision maker, give them, you know, some of your perspectives on this. And it's not easy, right? We all say, I'm so tired of policy / politics. I just want to go do this or do that. I do too.
Yeah,
but
I think we all do.
If we don't step up and grab the wheel, someone else is going to grab the wheel, and they're going to go a direction that's not good for us.
Yeah, exactly. And that seems to be what's happening right now is the individuals that want to have the change that we would prefer not seeing are the ones that are grabbing the wheel and greasing the, you know, cogs and stuff and getting things done. Well, like you were stating, you know, a lot of us would rather be out in the hills and glassing and the things we love to do, but, you know, those are going to come at a cost. If we continue to turn our cheek to it, someday that road to get to that, your favorite spot's not going to be there anymore. It's going to have a name on it and it's going to be blocked off. And And you're going to wonder why, and it's going to be because you turned a cheek.
I always forget to do this, Randy, but Dave is actually Dave's the current president of the Nevada Bow Hunters Association. So he's extremely involved in, all aspects of bow hunting in the state and pushing for, changes to the let-off regulation, all that stuff. So Dave does a lot of that himself.
To me, those are the heroes of hunting and of conservation are these volunteers, people like what you're doing, Dave, the hunter ed instructors, the people who go out and volunteer on a fence pole or go help with noxious weeds or water development. When I've been to Nevada and I've looked at the crowd of people who are helping on those water catchments, those guzzlers I've worked on, I was just thought so remarkable what a vast and wide spectrum of people who were there. I'd ask them, have you ever drawn a sheep tag? No, probably never will, but I know this helps other wildlife. And so there's so many of these unsung heroes of conservation and of hunting that I wish I could tell every one of their stories, because like you, Dave, like others, they are giving something with no guarantee that they're going to get anything out of it other than the satisfaction that they've done what they could for something they care about.
Yep. It's beautiful to see, because I've been on some of those guzzler builds and you see, like you were stating, such a vast group. You got folks that are, in their older years, and then you've got kids helping out. I mean, I was at one where you got, 9-10-year-old kids that are dragging posts or a fence or a piece of metal for the curtain or something, and you're just like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
And that's a perfect jumping off point. Randy, you mentioned the stories of some of these unsung heroes. Tell your story and your involvement in the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. I know you've been extremely vocal about that organization. What is it about RMEF that got you hooked?
Yeah, actually, I got hooked at Mark Foran Strike.
Around. Oh, yep. Yeah.
There's a magazine on the counter there that's called Bugle Magazine. This is in 1986. I'm like, What is this? Right across the road was Johnson Sporting.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I got to become a member of this thing. Someday I want to elk hunt. Well, little did I know that 4 years later, I would move to Montana. And when I moved to Montana, I started looking around who's doing the most work in habitat, who's doing the most work in access. And so I volunteered for the local committee, got involved in that, and got involved in the public land movement of creating more access. And every time I got involved in those things, I'd look around and who was the group that seemed to always be there for hunters? It was the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And so volunteered for them for the longest time, from 2013 through 2019. I did 6 years on the National Board of Directors, and I'm just blown away by how much great work they do because of 200,000 amazing and generous members, because of 11,000 completely dedicated and optimistic volunteers. They get a lot done, and they get it done because of those people, and they do it for all of us who love the outdoors. And so there's tons of good groups out there. For me, I happen to be touched in a very tangible way by the work of the Elk Foundation. So that's where I kind of put my shoulder behind the wheel. But whatever group it is, whatever species landscape that fascinates you or you find compelling, go be a member of that organization that speaks for that species or that landscape.
Yeah, very good point. I'm a life member of the Muley Fanatic Foundation. For whatever it is about mule deer, that's what gets me going. The Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation is a cornerstone of conservation groups. I mean, like you said, what was it, 200,000 members?
Yeah,
just absolutely massive.
Yeah, I think about Nevada. When I was going to college there in 1985, I think it was, they adopted their first elk plan. and the statewide elk objective was 3,000 elk. Well, through the work of a lot of your people, a lot of your hunter groups, a lot of the volunteers for the Elk Foundation showed up, and now your statewide objective is over 12,000.
Yep, right.
I mean, that's 4x the amount of elk than what they ever dreamed you would have. And so a lot of hard work made that happen, and it was done because people who showed up, people got organized. In a lot of instances, the Elk Foundation and their local chapters served as that way of organizing. But that's how things get done. That's how conservation happens. What is it? Today they're doing the draw, right, at Endow, and then 2 days they'll post the results.
Yeah, it's the draw was today, and then I think it's like with 24 hours or something like that, the results will be published, something in that fashion, by Friday.
And when that happens, we always hear, and we might feel it ourselves, dang it, I didn't draw this year. Boy, draw odds are just tough with the drought, you know, whatever it might be. I always tell people, if you want to double your draw odds, work to try put twice as many mule deer on the landscape of Nevada.
Man, very good point.
If you want to double the chance that you might get to hunt elk in Nevada, put double the amount of elk on the landscape in Nevada.
That's a very good way. You know, I don't think I've ever heard anybody put it that way, Randy, but that's a very, very good point.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of the legacy we have as hunters. We've always tried to do that. When we get in a trap is when we want to fight and argue over, oh, who's going to get the last mule deer tag in this unit? Well, that's not what we want. We don't want to fight over scraps. We've always built a bigger pie. We've always tried to increase the herds. And that's what's got us through times when, you know, drought or habitat destruction or hard winters or whatever might have numbers down for a while. Building those back up is what increases our opportunity to go out there.
Yep, very true.
Hey, so jump off from there. Let's talk Nevada hunting. What are let's go elk, and what are some units you like for elk in Nevada?
Relative to other states, Nevada does not have a bad elk hunt that I can think of. I haven't hunted elk down at Mount Charleston, so I can't speak to that. But I've helped friends who've had Nevada tags. I had a Nevada tag in 2005 down in units 221, 22, and 23.
That's where I got mine.
That was remarkable.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
When I go there on a lot of my mule deer hunts, the quality of bulls that I see, I'm like, oh, my gosh. I need another tag here. But that's a whole lot easier to say than to do. But I really, for me, it's hard to talk about any specific unit. Like, I remember sitting on Spruce Mountain one time and glassing for mule deer, and here comes four bachelor bulls still in the velvet. And any of the four were bulls of a lifetime. I'm like, oh, my gosh. I've done the same thing in other parts of Nevada. I helped a friend who had a tag up in the far northeast, and we hunted mostly in Unit 81. And some of the elk we saw was just fantastic. And your agency does a better job than any agency out there of providing an amazing hunting opportunity on a what most would consider a pretty marginal landscape for elk, for mule deer, for whatever. But if you gave me an elk tag for any unit in Nevada, I'd say yes.
Yeah. You mentioned Spruce Mountain. That's one of my favorite units. I've hunted that unit a handful of times. And, yeah, some of the bulls you see there, just absolutely incredible. The first 380 bull I ever saw, you know, on the hoof, not in a picture somewhere, was on Spruce Mountain.
Yeah. And, you know, all those water catchments there are what provides habitat, because there is some forage, but without the water that's there, you don't have habitat. And there's a ton of catchments there. Guzzler things, not just there, but in the Pequops and other places.
Yeah.
And, now you got me excited.
Yeah, good. Hey, on. Friday's coming soon.
Bull tag on Friday.
Yeah, it's coming up here real soon. So is antelope still your favorite animal to pursue?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I plead guilty.
What did it, what is it about antelope?
You know, for me, one, they're they're unbelievable as far as table fare. I wish they were bigger. You know, I can eat one really quickly.
Yeah.
But they're uniquely North American, and the places they inhabit take me to places that I might otherwise not go. And these are places that are often very desolate. They are places where you gain an appreciation for how amazing these species are to make a living and prosper on this landscape. Use Central Nevada. You know, you take Highway 50, the loneliest highway in America, right? And you traverse and you see those big valleys running north and south. And you get out in some of those places, you would swear that there's not another person on the planet some days.
Oh, yeah.
And oh, for sure.
There's a group of pronghorn. There's another group of pronghorn. It's like, whoa, these are remarkable animals. Just the places that they're able to have success, how they're able to overcome super hot and dry summers, some really harsh winters, avoid predators. It's like, man, I wish I had one tenth of the skill an antelope has. And so that's, I don't know, they just fascinate me, the places they live and how they go about making a living.
Yeah.
I wish I could put it into better words, but it's still my favorite thing to do.
Don't touch that dial. After the break here, we'll get into a little more about antelope. Stay tuned to Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. You've got that how-to antelope hunting series. Plug that for a minute. What's in there? And 100% honesty, I will probably buy that because I've talked before, antelope I struggle with. Antelope just are a head-scratcher for me. So what am I going to learn from the program without giving it away completely?
Yeah, we have a platform, me and a few other folks. We built a platform a few years ago called outdoorclass.com. It's taking people who have a lot of experience to teach not basics. We're trying to teach more advanced type hunting, cooking, skills like that. It started with a platform called the University of Elk Hunting that my friend Corey Jacobson does. And we built from that. Now we have multiple elk courses, archery elk courses, survival courses. Remy Warren, he's a neighborhood guy for you fellas.
Yep.
Remy's done two. We launched his mule deer course last year. He's got another archery mule deer course that we're editing and it's going to come out really soon. My pronghorn course just came out last month. And in there, we have 12 chapters. We talk about how pronghorn evolved on this landscape and why that evolution determines what parts of the landscape they can use or can't use. So go look for them in the places they can use the landscape. Don't look for them in places where they can't be. And then we get into a chapter about archery tactics, rifle tactics. We have a chapter about how they behave in the pre-rut, how they behave in the peak rut, how they behave in the post-rut, what their food sources are, how varied they are, why the food source that they're looking for in August is different than the food source they're looking for in October, all kinds of stuff. So it was a chance for me to really nerd out on a species that I love. Obviously, you don't want to plagiarize anything. So I spent a couple months trying to find another pronghorn course out there in the world, and I couldn't find one. So got to build it from scratch.
I was going to say, where can people go to get this? The platform or whatever, is it through that hunttalk.com or is it through randynewberg.com?
All those platforms will lead you there in some way, but the easiest way is just go outdoorclass.com.
Okay.
And it'll take you right there. And for any time I'm on a show, like you guys being so kind to host me, we always give a promo code that if you go there and you use promo code Randy, they'll give you 20% off. So when you sign up, it's a one-year subscription, and you get access to every course. Every course that's there, all the future courses, as long as you're a subscriber, all for the same price. So,
everybody listening right now, if you go, the code is Randy.
R-A-N-D-Y, and that gets you 20% off not just the Antelope course, but all the courses on there?
Yep, because you get all the courses for one subscription price. So
very cool.
$99 you get all, I don't know how many courses are out there now, but there's quite a few of them, and there's more coming all the time. Really doing a lot of cooking courses because we hunt for food. We want people to understand how the best chefs in the world take care of this food and how they prepare it.
Because you do. You have to prepare wild game completely different than you do your commercialized food.
Yep. And just how you take care of it from the time you're lucky enough that you get one. Between then and when you get it home and get it in the freezer, there's a lot that you need to know there also to make sure you preserve that quality.
Yes. Well, and especially on those early season antelope hunts where you're talking about 97 degrees and no shade for 20 miles in any direction. Yeah.
Yeah, those archery antelope hunts, you got to be pretty quick about it. So, Randy, what bow do you shoot?
I have a Bowtech Solution.
Oh, nice.
I don't hold myself out to be the world's greatest archer. I've got more shoulder problems and wrist problems and stuff. My form is really bad, so I want the most forgiving bow I can find. I only shoot 60 pounds, and I love it. It's my favorite way to hunt because you're trying to get as close as you possibly can, but that's what I'm set up with.
I love the whole approach, the stock, the analyzing the landscape to figure out how I can get there and get a good, humane, solid shot off. It just...
And Dave actually took his bighorn sheep last year with a bow.
Whoa.
Yeah, exactly.
That is cool.
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool.
There's, I'm like you, Randy. I realized pretty quickly when I started getting involved in target archery and tournament archery, I thought, well, I'm a pretty good hunter. I've killed stuff with a bow. I know what I'm doing. And then I started meeting people like Dave, and I went, man, there's a different level out there, and I'm not at it.
Yeah, and I realized that, and now I only have a 40-yard pin. I have a 20, 30, and 40-yard pin. And I, even at 40 yards and under, I turn down more shots than I ever take. And I know some people watching our content are probably thinking, Newberg, you couldn't hit that thing at 48 yards? Well, maybe I could have, but unless I have that 99.9% feeling that when I release that arrow, that animal's, going to expire, I don't release it.
Yep.
And I've made a couple mistakes along the way. And there's nothing that ruins my day, my month, and my year worse than having made a mistake that I could have done better.
Yep.
So
I was going to ask you about the Antifa pizza that got you in Portland and and whether or not that has affected your bow shooting at all.
Yeah, so I got food poisoning in Portland.
And it was pizza, right?
In my hotel room. Yeah, from a pepperoni pizza. Oh, and they're doing a fundraiser for the Oregon Hunters Association. Pass out from vomiting, fall through a glass shower door, and sever three tendons with this big, nasty 8-inch gash on my right forearm.
Holy moly.
I have not been... Yeah, the surgeon, I just met with him this morning. This happened in late February. He was able to reattach and preserve two of the three tendons and reconstruct quite a bit of the muscles, but he's not released me to archery shooting yet.
Gotcha.
Can you wait till June? I'm like, yeah.
Well, you could always do like Remy and use a mouth tab.
Yeah, everyone says that. I'm like, you know what? Remy is a talented individual. Yeah. He's one of a kind. I'm not that good. I struggle with two good hands, so there's no way I'm using a mouth.
Yeah. He's pretty exceptional. It's awesome watching him figure out ways. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw the pictures from Andy showed me the pictures, and I went, oh my God, look like a shark attack.
It did. When they removed the cast after 2 weeks, the surgeon looked at it and said, you know, if I was you, I'd tell people I got bit by a shark. That's a way better story than food poisoning from a pepperoni pizza.
Yeah, yeah, so, in Portland, Oregon, of all places, too.
Falling through a shower.
Yeah, his nurse grabbed my phone and took a picture, probably the one Andy showed you, and it does look like a big shark bite.
Yeah, and it's gnarly.
I tell people when they say, what happened? I'm like, oh, I got bit by a shark. And at first they're like, yeah, right. And I show them that picture, and they're like, oh, my goodness, you did get bit by a shark. Yeah. And so if people hear two versions of the story out there and one involves a shark, for my street cred, I hope they go with the shark bite.
Yeah. All right. I'll start pushing that narrative for you. I got you on that. Hey, so Randy, anything else we didn't really get to? Anything that you wanted to promote or talk about?
Well, I just want people to go out there and hunt and have great experiences. And when you go out and do this, realize that this is a special thing we get to do. And we are only here for so long. You know, we're kind of borrowing it. And there are kids and grandkids and people yet unborn who I think most of us want to have these same experiences. The reason we have these experiences, someone who's probably long passed on did something to make it possible for us. And the legacy, this generational legacy about hunting and our culture and how we put our shoulder to the wheel for conservation, that needs to continue if hunting is going to continue. So when you're out there, enjoy it, have fun, bring people with who you enjoy being with. But when you do have time or you have a little money or you can help out, try to do that. Because the ability for hunting to continue is dependent upon all of us trying to make a bit more of a difference.
Yeah, well put.
I just appreciate you coming onto the show and really motivating me as a hunter and an outdoors person to get more involved in the things I cherish and the things that I'm passionate about. So I really appreciate that, and I just want to say thank you.
Can't thank you enough. Thank you for taking the time, Randy. I'm so glad we got to do this. And yeah, next time you're in Nevada, don't be a stranger. Good luck on Friday. I've got my fingers crossed for you. I know there's going to be a bull tag in there with your name on it.
Or an antelope.
Well, I sure hope so, guys. Thanks so much. Best of luck to you guys. I hope that the tags are filling your mailbox after the draw. And it wouldn't be right without saying go Wolfpack, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
Hey,
thank you.
Thanks, Randy. Good to talk to you.
Take care, guys.
Take care.
That is all the time we have this Sunday. Stay tuned for Tom Gresham's Gun Talk coming up at 11, only on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.